Germany is Europe's most powerful nation. It's at the centre of EU decision-making. When good or bad things happen, the influence of Germany is never far away. But its domestic politics still perhaps don't get the attention they deserve. As the country looks forward to national elections later this year, today we ask, where is Germany going, and what might this tell us about the future of Europe?
A shock announcement and the beginning of the end of Angela Merkel's almost two decades of rule of Germany's centre-right CDU party.
Despite being rather small in stature, Angela Merkel casts a long shadow.
The Greens have made major gains in recent years, rising to become Germany's second strongest party.
Maybe we'll have a young Green woman chancellor.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. We're joined by two guests today. Franziska Heinisch is an activist with the Justices Global Europe Collective and author of the book Wir haben keine Wahl, We Have No Choice, a manifesto against giving up. Christos Katsoulis is a foreign policy analyst and director of the London office of Friedrich Ehrbuch Stiftung, the political education foundation loosely aligned with the German social democracy. We'll be picking their brains on where Germany is going after the Merkel era, what the big controversies are in the run-up to the September elections, and how hopeful they are on the prospects for progressive political change. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. Hope you enjoy it.
Christos, let's start with you. Long time no speak from Another Europe. Can you give us an initial rough guide to the election? Maybe talking us through the three candidates looking to replace Angela Merkel.
Yeah, I can at least try to. At the moment, there are three candidates. One is her successor as party leader of the Christian Democratic Union, Armin Laschet. The second is Annalena Baerbock, who is the chancellor candidate for the Green Party. And the third one is Olaf Scholz, who is chancellor candidate for the SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Germany. You could say that there is also a chance of the Liberals having a candidate in the race because they are on par with the SPD at the moment. But let's focus on these three. Armin Laschet is the successor of Angela Merkel in the CDU, and he's kind of a continuity candidate in that kind of sense. There was a nice article describing him as trying to get through the sleeper train into the chancellery, meaning he doesn't try to do anything radical. He's trying to occupy the center ground of politics. Nothing really new in his announcement. He doesn't even have a manifesto yet. So he's trying to occupy what Angela Merkel occupied for the CDU for the past 15 years. Annalena Baerbock, on the other hand, the only female candidate, the only younger candidate, she's, from my point of view, standing for change, something fresh, something new, and a very credible and long-standing focus on the question of climate crisis, which is one of the founding leitmotifs of the Greens. So she's standing for making Germany better prepared for tackling climate crisis. And Olaf Scholz is the candidate for the SPD. They have a manifesto already. He was the first one in the race. He's focusing on a society of respect and preparing Germany for the future as well. I'm a bit biased talking about him. As you know, we're close to the SPD, but I would say he's brilliant. The SPD generally is brilliant on substance. The program really, the manifesto really looks good, but there seems to be a relationship problem with the voters. The SPD is trailing on 14-15%. And the question is, what's the main message? Whereas the Greens are standing for transformation, change, something new. The CDU is continuity, things as they are. And the SPD is something in the middle, which is always kind of a difficult position, isn't it?
Yeah, and just to stay on that for a brief second, Olaf Scholz, when he was initially selected by the SPD, he was seen as a continuity centrist candidate. This idea that he could make the best claim to be the successor for Merkel. Would he be doing better if the CDU had gone for one of the more, you know, radical right, if you like, candidates? There were a few, as I understand it, who were pitching very much a discontinuity with the Merkel government. Is that a right analysis? Am I barking up the wrong tree?
It's a difficult analysis because we're in a situation where there are very few certainties. There is no incumbent at this election. Angela Merkel is not standing anymore. And there was a rationale inside the SPD, as far as I know, that there will be kind of a vacuum at the top of German politics, and people will try to have a safe hands, and Olaf Scholz is standing for that. I think Armin Laschet is, from a point of view of the Greens as well as the SPD, the better candidate. He's probably easier to fight than Markus Söder, who was more popular, and he's even more slippery, I would say, than Armin Laschet. And the CDU was probably never going in the direction of being too close to the AfD. We saw that in the Länder elections in Saxonia last Sunday, where they had quite a clear stance against the AfD, and by that could gain more votes than before. So I think the rationale was also done in the middle of a pandemic, where people thought, let's try a safe hands, the centrist candidate, Olaf Scholz. And that's the rationale they're standing with.
Francisco, what do you see as the main dividing lines between the candidates? And from an activist perspective, which direction would you like to see them going in, and who do you think's the most likely to go there?
I mean, if we talk about dividing lines, we're talking about climate action. I think we're talking about social reforms. We also talk about like how we could restructure the economy, getting out of the corona crisis. But I think that there are not as many dividing lines as they actually should be. I mean, the Green Party presents themselves as this progressive anti-establishment force, sometimes also as the representation of the climate justice movement in parliament, while actually, taking part in governing in 11 out of 16 state governments in Germany. And if you take a look at their record there, you can see that they do not challenge polluting corporations. They stick to conservative-made plans, for example, mobility. And suddenly they are opposed to climate activists they often claim to represent in parliament. If we take a look at Annalena Baerbock, she also used the slogan from the climate justice movement, system change, not climate change, on their party's congress. And symptomatically, she then put that into perspective, saying it's as revolutionary as a building loan contract, which is an example of a middle-class lifestyle and an example which is relatable for people who tend to be more conservative. So I think the Greens benefit from the fact that no other party is authentically associated with climate protection. And through the rise of the Fridays for Future movement, they have been able to establish themselves as the strongest party among, for example, under 30 years old. But in the end, they are not that progressive new force, and we will probably end up with a coalition between the Green Party and the CDU. So I don't see as many dividing lines between, for example, the Green Party and the CDU as they actually should be when we talk about climate protection. Also, with Olaf Scholz, the candidate for the Social Democratic Party, the downward spiral continues with the SPD, and he's a candidate that represents no one else in the party and embodies the Grand Coalition, the coalition between the SPD and the CDU. He embodies a neoliberal SPD, which kind of works as CDU light, and he embodies a bureaucratic style of politics. He talks about moving forward. He talks about the future a lot. He talks about respect for the people, regaining power for the workers, but he's also a person who played a huge role in establishing the agenda, the social reform package in the 2000s. So I don't think that there really is as much of a dividing line between the Green Party, the CDU, and the SPD, which is tragic, I think, also from an activist perspective. Then there's this absent power and pressure from the left, as we could also see in the election last weekend in Saxonia-Anhalt. There's just not that much power from the left and pressure to push forward with climate protection, to push forward with social reforms, to actually restructure the economy in forms of, for example, a Green New Deal, a really progressive Green New Deal. And it almost seems as if none of the parties really want to impose real change on the citizens, and everyone talks about a new beginning and the future, but it's like not really disruptive, I think, and they hardly do anything to end neoliberalism, as there was the saying in the beginning of the corona crisis. So as an activist, I'm not really hopeful when I look at the elections in September. And I think that it's not so much about what I want them to say, but what we need them to do. Because also if you look at the rise of right-wing politics, we need to form a real alternative. We need to push forward for radical fundamental change, and we're not seeing this in this election. And I think that if we end up with a conservative coalition between the Green Party and the CDU, yeah, we can talk a lot about like abolishing Hartz IV, we can talk a lot about a Green New Deal, but it won't be happening. And so I think a lot of young activists look at the election, yeah, with a feeling of hopelessness. But I think that there's also, if you look at the social and political movements of the last years, that gives me hope. People are angry. People are going on the streets. People are protesting. People want change. And I think that the election day could mark a new start for political movements in Germany to push for progressive reforms, to push for progressive policy. Yeah, but that needs the power from the people, and the change won't come out of parliament, I'd say, right now.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because the conversation in the UK is very much looking at the success of the German Greens and really rejoicing. But from your description, it sounds more like they've suffered a sort of hollowing out and a crisis of confidence that we associate more with kind of Labour and left-wing parties. Is that what's happened?
Yeah, I mean, on paper, the Greens want a 1.5 degree compliant policy with climate neutrality well before mid-century. They want an investments in a lot of things. They want affordable housing. But there are a lot of contradictions in communications in their program. And also, if we look at the draft for the election program, the party pledges to adhere to the 1.5 degree limit and announces a phase of the coal in 2030, but the climate measures envisaged are far from sufficient to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and to tackle the climate crisis, for example. And so I think the rise of the Green Party is also a sign of the absent pressure from the left, and also a sign of the absent potential of the left and the powerlessness of the left right now, because in reality, the Green Party, I would say, are pragmatic centrists. They presenting themselves as this pragmatic liberal force. They are unapologetically pro-European. They are progressive on issues such as women's and minority rights, but they are moderate in their stance on regulating big business. And they try to portray themselves as the party both of social movements and of businesses. And as a pragmatic centrist party, what I'd call them, it's not really a sign of hope for progressives, I think, but it's the only party that manages to present themselves in a modern way, in a diverse way, in a way that promises change, I think, right now. And that may be from looking at the Greens, that may be a good sign, but they're not really a left force. So it's not a sign of hope for the left and for the activists that have been doing all those climate protests, for example, for the last years.
I suppose there's two things that I find interesting in response. On the one hand, I think this election would be a much more dramatic election for the international context. Those of us who are on the outside looking into the bubble of German politics and really have a massive amount of concern, and indeed, across Europe, a stake in what happens. It's a hugely important, hugely consequential election in general, but it would have been much more important had the mainstream German centrist parties, and in particular Angela Merkel, not come behind Eurozone reform last year. If we had been, through the whole of the coronavirus crisis and pandemic, desperately in need of a European stimulus again, and if the German elite had just stuck to their no, no, no common borrowing, etc. position. And so the fact that they broke with that last year creates a bit of a, I think, as you're alluding to actually, Franziska, quite a centrist consensus in German politics around maintaining some kind of pro-European reform position in the context of the Next Generation EU programme, but very cautious about taking that any further. The other thing that occurs to me is that I think a lot of politicians in the Western world and are grappling with the demands of the situation, especially in relation to climate change, and trying to find leaders and arguments that are trying to convince people that this thing that represents a huge and existential risk to the sustainability of life on this planet, nonetheless can be tackled with really relatively minor or non-life-changing reforms to people's everyday lives. And that's one of, I think, the big democratic conundrums. You see that with the Biden stimulus in the United States. It puts a lot of faith in the power of technology, and not necessary, and in order to try and say, well, we don't need huge changes in everyday life. Don't worry, you can still drive your big cars and everything, but we're going to have this technological revolution that saves us. And I think this debate, in some ways that you've described, is very similar to that.
I think your analysis is absolutely correct. And Francisca is also right. We have kind of a very crowded center space with the three biggest parties in there, trying all of them, not only the Greens, to be very climate friendly, at least in their manifesto. So there's a huge lot of greenwashing going on, especially in the CDU, but also in the SPD now. Climate neutrality or carbon neutrality is one of the first topics in the manifesto. But the main message is to the people, don't worry, there will be no real change. We'll manage that by technological innovations. We'll manage it by small levers in the economy. Nobody is tackling, as Francisca said, big business. Nobody is, or no party is having a transformative agenda for the economy, for the society, or for the climate crisis. So it's more about style than substance. And that's maybe one of the problems of this election and why young people look at that with, and I can fully understand that, with a bit of hopelessness.
If the Greens do take the chancellery, what would be the main differences between a government led by Annalena Baerbock to the current government? Foreign policy would be a big difference. No, that's what's talked about a lot internationally.
I don't think so, to be honest.
Oh, interesting.
First of all, we need to take into account that the German governance system is a compromise-producing machine. The interdependency of decision-making on the federal and state level forces every government to compromise with other parties. So there won't be radical change possible, first of all. The second thing is, I think the climate crisis will be the main priority. It would be the kind of leitmotif for a green government and being kind of mainstreamed into other policies, but in a very moderate dose. And the same applies to foreign policy. We will hear more about human rights. We will hear more about upholding values all over the world. But as we have seen with the state governments of the Greens in Baden-Württemberg, for example, there is a certain cautiousness in tackling the interests of big business. Baden-Württemberg is the home of Mercedes-Benz, and we see the prime minister of the Greens being very cozy to these businesses. And I fear the same will apply also for a federal government led by the Greens. There will be a bit more talk about Chinese human rights violations, but I don't think there will be a real hardened stance against the Chinese government. The talk about weapons delivered to Ukraine by Robert Habeck is a kind of a test balloon, but I don't think that the Green Party will radically change foreign policy. The European issue is something shared by the SPD as well as the CDU and the Greens. I don't think that there are real substantive differences. So it's more about style and it's about atmosphere as well. You shouldn't forget Angela Merkel is governing for 15 years. There are many young people who haven't lived under a different chancellor. So we shouldn't underestimate also the fact that a new government could bring an atmosphere of change, an atmosphere of hope, an atmosphere of possible new developments or possible also new ways of doing politics. And that should be possible under a green government.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you put it like that. And I was referring to like the people talk about the Greens being more, as you say, more combative when it comes to things like Chinese human rights, more assertive on those issues, and more critical of the proposed trade agreement investment treaty between the EU and China on those human rights grounds. But one thing you didn't mention, which is also raised as a big area of difference, is Nord Stream 2 Could you just tell us about that?
The Greens have a bit more critical stance to Nord Stream 2, but Nord Stream 2 is nearly a done deal. The Americans will have no more sanctions on it. So I don't think that the Greens will stop that, because it would mean kind of a provocation against Russia. I think they hope that it will be a done deal until they come into government, and then won't change anything. That's my take at the moment, but maybe time corrects me.
And do you both see Olaf Scholz as out of the race and the SPD as a done deal at this point?
Franziska, you go first.
Yes, I really think so, because the SPD has done everything they really could. They announced Olaf Scholz as chancellor candidate really early. They came up with an election program and their manifesto really early. They tried to put all these forces in the party together and to form an alliance behind Olaf Scholz, because he wanted to become chair of the SPD, and he failed with that. But the euphoria has so far not been there, and also failed to materialize. They did everything they could, and still they are polling by around like 15%. And they are third party behind the CDU right now and the Green Party. So, yeah. And after the election in Saxony-Anhalt, where the SPD lost again, they shared some statistics where people favored Olaf Scholz to be next chancellor, but people vote for a party in the end. And the SPD only gets 15%. And that means that I think that, Olaf Scholz and the SPD are out of the race. And I think it's due to them not really changing their neoliberal agenda and like performance. They are not, they continue with that, but they're trying to get out of that, but it doesn't really have an effect, and people do not trust them anymore and do not trust the alternative they are claiming right now. And maybe it's good for the SPD to be in opposition, while at the same time, I think it's a tragedy, because the best thing that could happen in this election is a progressive coalition between the Green Party, the SPD, and the left. There's only a small chance of that happening, and it would be most probably be under a Chancellor Annalena Baerbock. Yeah. So I think Olaf Scholz and the SPD are out of the race. There is a small chance for a progressive coalition after the election, but we will most probably end up with Armin Laschet or Annalena Baerbock as chancellor and a coalition between the Green Party and the CDU. So I don't think that there really is hope for the SPD, because the story of like renewing and a new beginning for this party has been there for about the last 3-4 years, and there wasn't a success in doing that. So right now I don't think that there is much hope for Olaf Scholz.
Christos, just to add a question onto this, the leadership of the SPD is not the same as the chancellor candidate. That's something that listeners might find a bit confusing. Can you explain that for us? And I believe the leadership are more aligned to the left.
Yes, there is a bit more tendency to the left of the leadership. It's not unusual for German parties to have a different leader and a different candidate. That has happened with the CDU-CSU as well. And for the SPD, it's also something that has happened before. We had a different leader and different chancellor candidate. This creates, in the end, mostly difficulties when you get into government. If not, it's not so much of a problem. Concerning the question of being out of the race, at the moment, it looks like that. If you look at the numbers, I'm not sure if something might happen in the coming months. We still live in a pandemic. We have an election without an incumbent. And that was the main theme in the past three state elections. The governing prime minister won, and it had also a real big personal effect. That will be not the case in the federal elections. And I think that creates a bit of hope for Olaf Scholz. That's what he's bargaining on. And the last thing I wanted to add to what Franziska said is, I think this is the real big challenge to get the CDU, to get the conservatives out of government. That will be the main issue to fight for. And therefore, I don't think Olaf Scholz and the SPD are out of the race. If they can be part of a progressive government in the end, that will be really helpful in every vote, and that counts.
So So the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, has moved consistently to the right since its formation in 2013. And now it's very radical and kind of frighteningly fascistic, white supremacist in its nature. It seems to be stagnating in support, but is very much still on the scene, as the recent election in Saxony-Anhalt region showed. How big a problem do you think Germany has with the resurgence of this alt-right politics?
I think we have a big problem here, because the circumstances of the last election in Saxony-Anhalt are special. We're in a pandemic where people rally around the flag of the government. And we see that also in the national polls, where the AfD right now is at 10%. But the AfD has established itself on the political scene, and it will remain, from my point of view. It has drawn on the discontent of many people, of people who are fearing more social inequality, who are fearing that there will be more and more left behind by the system and by the economic developments that are coming, who are afraid of change, or afraid of the things we need to do to fight the climate crisis. And the AfD draws on that, and going in a more and more conspirational, white supremacist, fascistic direction, as you correctly said. And what makes me really worry is that we have in the east of Germany, but also in parts of the west, real big strongholds of the AfD. And the idea of the, as Franziska just described, of the democratic parties asking voters to rally around the democratic flag without having a real alternative or trying to meet the discontent of these people to try to remedy the situation and have a real political alternative for them. That makes me worry, because it's normally it's the last bullet to ask them, vote for us and not for the bad guys, and not vote for us because we have the better proposals.
I was wondering if the trend that we've seen in previous years is still present, in the sense that Germany has been a huge recipient country for refugees and migrants through the course of the migration crisis. And like lots of radical right parties, this is something that the AfD has really mobilized around, this idea of the immigrant invasion from the global south and so on. Where do those migrants go to in Germany? Am I right in thinking that they still tend to flow to the more prosperous western part of the country? So you get a trend which is similar to other parts of Europe, where areas of the country which are actually quite low recipient areas for migrants and refugees have very high levels of immigration sentiment. Does that argument hold?
Yes, I think so. And like Christoph said, it's not really the fact that the migrants are there that the AfD uses for their right-wing politics. It's the fear of losing status, of rising social inequality they use by instrumentalizing people migrants coming to Germany. That's not really the real issue there. It's more the fear of like losing, yeah, their social status, of losing their jobs, of rising inequality. And rather than like actually fighting to win power and to shift power to the many, people are reacting to that fear with like looking at the migrants being like, okay, well, it's we need to blame them. And the AfD uses this narrative, and they in a provocative way, and they have success with that, because the left doesn't really focus on the topics that are important, that because the left doesn't really offer, or also progressive forces do not really offer an alternative which reacts and which makes the fear of inequality, the fear of the future, go away. And I think that we need progressive parties to focus on the Green New Deal, on progressive migration politics right now, who actually put things into perspective and who react to this narrative of fear and to this ideology which is based on fear with creating hope. And I think that we've seen that with Sanders or also with Corbyn, that there is a possibility to do that. And also in Germany, we have this huge movement called Seebrücke, which is an alliance for progressive flight and migration policies. And we have the sea rescue groups So there are people fighting for change, and we need progressive forces to offer a real alternative, to make the fear go away and to offer people an a real alternative. And I think that also the fear that is like, yeah, put on this whole migration topic is often rooted in the losses people had to face during decades of neoliberalism, because in every crisis, big corporations are winning, the super rich are winning, and lots of people are losing. And also in the East, people are affected, yeah, the most, and are affected in a crucial way when it comes to climate action and like cutting fossil fuels, when it comes to regions changing. So we need to face that. And it's not the real issue of like migrants being there. It's more the fear because of decades of neoliberalism, which makes people more likely to, yeah, actually follow a narrative like the AfD is trying to pose in German politics. And sometimes, for example, with Sarah Wagenknecht, there has been a lot of critical thinking about that, but sometimes the left hops onto that fear and tries to do the same. And it's like, okay, we need to build power for the German workers and all the other people coming here. That's bad for Germany. I don't think that that's the right strategy. And I don't think that that's a way of how the left could actually win. We need to focus on topics where the left is strong, where we have good answers, and where we actually could create hope for the people for a better future.
A lot of progressives in the UK are really excited about Biden's programme, not just the programme itself, but the fact that he did look like this very boring candidate. And it turned out that by kind of harnessing the energy of those further to the left of him in order to win, he then used that energy to devise a policy platform. Do you feel that US politics is influencing things in Germany as well? Or is the terrain of debate completely different? Francisco?
I think that progressives and also the left looks at the US context in a hopeful but also critical way. I think that we can learn a lot from the Sanders movement, for example, and we can learn a lot from how the Green New Deal was introduced in the US, I think, because it's not rooted in like Biden's agenda, right? It's rooted in activist work. It's rooted in grassroots movements. And I think that's important. And that, I think, creates hope for left campaigning.
I think the interesting thing is that he dressed in a very boring way, of course, a very centrist way. But the people around him, the people, the staff of his administration is inspired by activism, is inspired by climate action, and they're bringing that into government. And that is something that should bring us a bit of hope. And maybe we should remember what happened in the 90s. It took a bit of time until what happened in the US with Bill Clinton came over to Europe, first to the UK and then to Germany. So there is a bit of a time gap in learning. But at the moment, we have still a problem of trust between Germany and the US. Donald Trump managed to really shatter the confidence in America, in the German population. So maybe it will take a bit of more time, that not only the Greens, but also the SPD and the Linke look very careful at what's going on. And if there's any success in what the Americans do, I'm very, very sure that we'll try to include that in their manifestos and maybe even in their government policy if they are able to oust the conservatives.
I think in particular, Biden has really turned over the trade liberalization agenda. I mean, his most recent statements on that are really interesting. And of course, it connects to his position on the coronavirus vaccine as well, because these trade deals have been for many years really part of a corporate takeover politics. The Obama administration that Biden was such a big part of was really key to negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Biden has now come back and continued the position of the Trump administration by saying, you know, we don't want America to be involved in TPP. Britain, meanwhile, wants to join it. So I think on that dimension, Biden is a really interesting figure in terms of, as you say, Christos, what he's trying to do globally, and also just the sheer scale of the fiscal stimulus. I guess before we go into extra time, my final question, if I may, would be, you know, the German economic stimulus is really quite big too. I mean, it's by some distance, I believe, the biggest in Europe. Would your critique of it, Franziska, be that it's mainly favouring a business agenda rather than the benefits of the spending going to, you know, workers and social programmes and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good that we changed from like German austerity politics to now investing in infrastructure. But yeah, I would say exactly that this could have been a contribution to a restructuring process of the economy. This could have been a contribution to climate action. This could have been a contribution to also distributing wealth and everything. And it just hasn't been so far. Who has the big corporations have profited from the stimulus package more than the people or like small businesses. And it's not really changing something in the structure of how the German economy looks like or how the situation with the climate crisis is. And it could have. But I think it's good that we can see a change in fiscal politics, and we need that to remain after the corona crisis, to not go back to austerity politics as they were, but to invest into the future and to invest like in everything we need as infrastructure, because that's the only way we can really do everything to tackle the climate crisis, and we can really combine social and ecological fights and social and ecological battles. So I think, yeah, that could have been a contribution. It hasn't been so far, but at least we see a change in how we invest. And I think that the stimulus package itself and the idea of investing in the future, that is something that should remain.
And so to go into extra time, obviously Brexit is not a big deal in the German elections, and tragically, I feel, never will be again. But it is still important, unfortunately, to the beleaguered listeners of this podcast. So can you tell us, is there basically a consensus between the German parties on relations with the UK and what Brexit will look like? Christos, you can start with that if you like.
Yeah, I think with the exemption of the AfD, the other parties agree that it's sad that the UK has left the European Union, but there is now a will to somehow be pragmatic and build relations, make them a bit more stable. There will be probably also an aim to somehow strengthen the bilateral relationship with institutions for young people and so on and so forth. But the clear stance of all parties is that Europe comes first, and that will define the relationship with the UK. The AfD is a different issue. I believe that they're looking towards the UK and will try to exploit every little success they see, be it in the vaccination process during the pandemic, be it in trade deals or whatever. They will always try to uphold that and nurture the idea of Germany going it alone as well. The idea of Germany leaving the European Union has not been included in their manifesto anymore, but I believe it's still on their agenda.
And Franziska?
Yeah, I agree with Christos. Since all parties except the AfD are pro-European, I think they're also interested in like having relations and being pragmatic with the UK. So, and also a young generation was confronted with the Brexit as like the first experience of, okay, what could happen to Europe next? And I think that has been an important moment for actually also German youth to focus on European politics more. But yeah, since all the parties are pro-European or declare themselves pro-European, I think that, yeah, all of them are interested in having good relations. Well, at the same time, I think that the AfD and also the EU border regime is a huge problem. And I think that, yeah, the AfD is still using this anti-European narrative to, and combined with migration policies to create fear and to get people on their side. And I think that Brexit should just be a reminder for progressives in Germany to fight against that. every time it comes up, but I think it's a sign of hope in Germany that it isn't included in the program of the AfD anymore. And concerning relations to UK, I think that, yeah, I agree with Christos.
I mean, I think that a lot of kind of younger UK citizens and Remainers generally are very anxious about becoming politically isolated as well as isolated in terms of the economy, trade and foreign policy. You know, that there will be no space to collaborate with Europeans of the same mind now that we've left the EU and now that we're kind of largely irrelevant to the EU. Do either of you see any kind of potential for building alliances between this kind of very isolated UK and its progressive elements? Do you see anything in the climate movement or the trades union movement that could kind of hold the UK together with Europe? Even
that's why we're having this conversation.
I know. I just want more concrete action, Luke.
And I would say you're absolutely right. And the best example is the United States. If you look at how there is cross-pollinating between climate action on both sides of the Atlantic, I believe that especially climate is an issue that brings together young people, be there from the UK, the United States, or the rest of Europe. So there is a common issue, a common battle to fight, and that will be something that holds parties, that holds movements, that holds people together. I don't think that we need for that thing the institutions that allowed for political dialogue inside the European Union. That is something that will be fought in every house, in every community, and in every nation state, and in the European Union as well. So I think that is something that will still be a strong bond holding progressives on both sides together.
That's very positive.
I also think that in the climate movement, and especially with young people in the climate movement, collaborating is not even a question because they just do it naturally, because it's not even, the image of not doing that, facing a global crisis is just not working. And also I think that we have the young generation, which has been on the streets against the climate crisis. They grew up with this image of a globalist world and everything being globally intertwined. So I think that in the climate movement we see that naturally, and I think that also this is the only way to gain power for progressives. And I think so we just need to focus on concrete tactics and strategies on how to win in each state and how to win collectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of international pressures and interconnectedness, which is forcing us to do that in a way, forcing us to continue to have dialogues across national borders and engage in transnational civil society activity in order to change things. And to relate that to the first aspect of this conversation, I do think it's interesting that it was the big countries or the far right in big countries, i.e. the AfD, Marine Le Pen's Front National, or sorry, they have a different name now, National Rally, and of course the British radical right, that promoted the idea that it was possible to leave Europe, right? So it becomes quite a tangible possibility, or can appear as a tangible possibility when you have that kind of geopolitical clout. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that in smaller countries, the radical right is actually more cautious about the idea of leaving the EU. When we talked to Cas Muda, I can't remember, maybe it was a year ago or something. I mean, he tends to be quite pessimistic, the scholar of the who follows the radical right and analyzes them. And he warned that, at the moment, Brexit has had this effect on the European radical right that's saying, well, look, we don't want to get locked into these endless and difficult negotiations with the European Union. We have to readjust our strategy towards transforming or destroying, indeed, Europe from within. And so that is that's the trend at the moment. But he very much warned, well, at a certain point, you know, Britain may become an example for others to follow, not a failure story, and that would be a really dangerous moment. I have to say, looking at the trade data between Britain and its largest partner, the EU, there isn't much danger at the moment in those kind of brute material capitalist realities of Brexit being seen as a success story. But watch this space, I guess. Maybe it will still change.
Are we going to end on watch this space?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Thank you, everybody. That was really fascinating.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to you. And thanks for bringing us a bit more, a bit down at the end, Luke.
No, sorry. I thought there was a danger of ending on an optimistic note.
Please stop.